For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Across the Pacific, there's a moment many people know all too well. You open your payslip, look at the number, and you know that a foreigner you work with, one who does the same job, is earning more. Sometimes a lot more. But today we're focusing specifically on Papua New Guinea because in PNG, that gap is shockingly high. In some sectors, expatriates take home salaries up to 9 times higher than Papua New Guineans doing the exact same job. It's a system born in colonization, preserved through decades of government inaction, and still powerful enough to shape careers, limit opportunities, and quietly tell Papua New Guineans, especially women, what their labor is worth. And for many, the number of times they've felt that inequality is endless.
Which incident do I pick? Because there are so very many. Like, I could probably fill up, you know, a couple of A4 pages of the incidents that I personally experienced.
And it's not just the money. It's work perks as well. Roles with salaries, housing, school fees, packages not available to locals.
I had like a colleague who was an expatriate woman who looked after a kind of a similar size property portfolio than I did. She was on double what I was getting, not counting the fact that she was getting her housing paid for.
And while thousands of Papua New Guineans have lived this reality, one man has spent nearly 4 decades studying it. Dr. Leo Murray from the University of Papua New Guinea remembers the first time he learned the name for what everyone could feel.
And they were wearing a T-shirt called Equal Work for Equal Pay. There was a lot of disgruntled academics at the university feeling after they came back with masters and PhD, they were still paid lower than those expected teaching here.
In his landmark research, he's documented the gap and the devastating psychological impacts.
We found that in Papua New Guinea in particular, people feel demotivated.
Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Polytalk. Today, how pay imbalance continues to impact Papua New Guineans. Who wins, who loses, and why this system has been allowed to endure for so long. In the 1980s, Anya Blyton was a young PNG Australian woman living in the Northern Territory, earning a strong Australian salary and thriving in the banking sector. But she decided to return to Papua New Guinea, and when she did, the system reminded her of something brutal. The value of her labor seemed to depend entirely on her passport.
But I think I was on something like maybe $30,000 a year or whatever it was in those days. And as soon as I changed my citizenship, I was getting 200 kina a fortnight. I mean, who can live on 200 kina a fortnight? Even in the 80s, that wasn't much.
The message was unmistakable. The value of her labor depended on the passport she carried, not the experience she had. It was a stark introduction to how colonial-era pay structures still decided who deserved what. But it wasn't the last time she saw it. Her first major job in Papua New Guinea would confirm the system wasn't just a one-off shock. It was the norm.
So my first experience began my career in the public service, I suppose you would call it, in Port Moresby, working for a bank, which was owned by the government. It was the Papua New Guinea Banking Corporation. And I saw very, very early on that there was a wage disparity between the expatriate staff and national staff in the bank.
Inside the Papua New Guinea Banking Corporation, she saw a system that privileged foreigners with inflated titles, packages and perks, even when she believed they weren't qualified.
People that were not necessarily at an experienced level of a manager or hadn't worked previously as a manager, who were coming into not only just banks, but many other private sector as well, with the title manager. So that entitled them to, let's say, for instance, have their children's school fees paid, have their housing paid for, have their holiday airfares paid for, compared to your a national or a Papua New Guinea citizen who was working maybe at the same level. So you've got someone who might have a completely different background who's coming into Port Moresby and maybe managing teams of Papua New Guinean workers who didn't necessarily have the skill set or the capacity to do that.
For Papua New Guinean women like Anya, who was smart, ambitious, and deeply capable, it created a profound sense of resentment and a ceiling she could feel pressing down.
And maybe you're hearing a little bit of resentment in my voice. Yes, there is. And that was the same experience for a lot of us Papua New Guinean women at that time, because you're watching people who you think, who you know are less qualified than yourself, enjoying the benefits and the perks of that kind of that kind of wage system or remuneration system.
And more than resentment, it created roadblocks. Roadblocks designed to keep expatriates in positions that Papua New Guineans weren't allowed to grow into.
That was an absolute barrier. So those of us that might have been, had an eye on that kind of stepping up, let's say, being promoted into that rank, knew we weren't going to be promoted because that person needed to keep their job and they were only in Papua New Guinea for, let's say, a contract period for a limited time, let's say 3 years, 4 years, whatever it might be, and they needed that job, so you're certainly not going to get promoted into that position.
The dual wage system just didn't keep salaries unequal. It kept opportunities unequal. And Anya knew she wouldn't stay somewhere that had already decided her worth.
As you can imagine, that was my last job in the public service ever. I certainly wasn't going to stay at 200 kina a fortnight. Definitely wasn't going to be able to save any money or help my family.
She moved into the private sector. But even there, the dual wage system followed her.
I had like a colleague who was an expatriate woman who looked after kind of a similar size property portfolio than I did. She was on double what I was getting, not counting the fact that she was getting her housing paid for.
But among the frustrations, she's seen meaningful change too, especially for women coming up behind her.
But the positive side of that, though, is that you go into any bank in PNG now and there are women sitting behind that manager's desk. It is so lovely to see that. I mean, you can choose to be bitter about these things or you can choose to just look at it as a systemic kind of barriers to Papua New Guinean women's progress.
But those barriers still affect her every time she sees them repeat.
It is. Something that, it personally affects me each time I see it.
Because the most painful part of the dual wage system just isn't the pay gap. It's how it has shaped the expectations of Papua New Guinean women themselves. How generations have internalized the idea that foreigners deserve more. She saw it firsthand when she started her own business and hired her niece.
And I had a little business in Port Moresby at that time. And I was determined I was going to make a difference in my own family. So I employed only my nieces who were just coming out of the provincial high school. And we spent months and months getting her ready for the job market.
But when it came to salary expectations, her niece's answer stunned her.
She did not expect that she would be paid as much as the average foreigner. There is still that kind of conditioning.
Anya's expectation isn't isolated. What she lived through in the 80s and 90s was part of a much larger system, one that reaches back to colonial administration, when European officers were paid on one scale and Papua New Guineans were placed on another. That structure didn't disappear with independence. It became embedded in the machinery of the state, in the public service pay scales, in the banking sector, in engineering, in construction, in mining and extractives, and in aid-funded organizations. And crucially, in the places meant to build Papua New Guinea's future workforce. Because one of those sectors where the dual wage system has been most stubborn is in academia. Universities, the very institutions responsible for training the next generation of leaders, have long relied on expatriate contracts that offered higher salaries, housing, travel, and benefits far beyond what local lecturers could access. And it sent a clear signal. Even with the same qualifications, Papua New Guinean academics were valued less. Dr. Leo Marai, now one of PNG's foremost experts on pay inequality, remembers exactly when it hit him.
Well, I became interested in it when I came to the university in 1987, and I saw a senior academics at PNG, mostly locals, were having this protests at one point in time, and they were wearing a T-shirt called Equal Work for Equal Pay. At that time, there was a lot of disgruntled academics at the university feeling after they came back with masters and PhD, they were still paid lower than those expected to be. We were wondering what's happening, and then we realized that, you know, there's a difference between salaries that expatriates were getting and locals. I grew interested in that, and then I managed to get into the program of psychology, which I was interested in. And there I found, you know, a theory called equity theory. It states clearly that when people are paid the same and all this, everything's okay. You know, there's balance, people are happy, people are doing their work. But when there's inequity among workers or unequal, then you see a lot of tension. And it leads to issues like demotivation at work.
Dr. Marai, how have the impacts of the dual salary system played out in your life, personally?
Personally, it's been part of my life because when we start publishing works on that for my academic career, I began to take interest in fact back to my master's thesis as well. I did a study on dual salary, and we continue to publish in that area of work, leading to many empirical studies demonstrating that the dual salary is a bad recipe.
How has PNG's colonial history shaped the way the wages were structured for nationals versus expatriates?
Well, it was shaped during colonial times, and that times was maybe justified before independence when we still have low. You cannot see the difference emerging. But after independence, when we had a lot of locals going abroad and studying and getting masters or high degrees and so on, we can see that the gap still exists because those expatriates assume they came from developed economies. They see us as, let's say, they should be paid higher than us because the economy is highly expensive.
Now, in the early 2010s, former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill agreed to review the dual wage system, and the government commissioned researchers, including yourself, to deliver hard data on how deeply the pay gap ran. You published a landmark study, and that's considered foundational work for a look at the dual wage system. One of the first large-scale empirical measurements of expert and local pay gaps in the Pacific. One key finding was the ratio of disparity of 9-1. Can you explain what that meant in real terms, and what did it look like as a comparison between local workers?
The previous studies that we were doing were experimentally based or survey form, but this one was mostly kind of quasi-survey. It led to like a big sample size, about 200 people participate. And definitely we found that, you know, the dual salary was in existence across institutions. We had about 26 institutions, private to government, civil society that participated in this particular study. We found on average, expatriates were paid 9 times more than local, which means they're getting 9 times more than the salary a local worker earns in simple terms. So that's a big gap, and that's the biggest gap that we've seen so far across the globe.
Now, in your studies, what impact have you found the dual wage salary system had on local workers and their psychology, well-being, and productivity? And why is that so important?
I did a modeling kind of a thesis. Usually in those kind of situations where dual salary is evident, in psychology, we use a social comparison model. So on that basis, they evaluate, you know, position in terms of salary. We found that in Papua New Guinea in particular, people feel demotivated. Interestingly, we found also the expatriates were demotivated as well, that there were double demotivation effects taking place.
After you submitted your data and your study, when findings went to the then PNG cabinet, the review process stalled, and despite spending hundreds of thousands of kina, the government never acted on those recommendations. What were you told about why nothing further happened?
The reason stated was personal reason and costly. That was it. So it was very disappointing for me to see that government have talked about paying academics better, reducing the gaps and all this, but it's a lip service. The work has been done, the data has been provided, but nothing has been done.
What change have you seen in this area over the years, and are there sectors where wages have become better for Papua New Guineans or worse under the dual wage system?
From my observation, I think it's you can see that it's increasing. It's not getting better for us.
What do you believe is the solution to this problem? How should it be handled by government?
What I think is that the government needs to open up its mindset to see that there's a real need. The need for the government to do now is to take action, because there's data showing clearly. When my study was done in 2013, and so far I've stopped a bit because of this disappointment that the government is not doing enough. And you can see the university, for example, where I work here. A lot of our very good academics are leaving. Many of our PhDs are leaving for greener pastures. And I think the government needs to be proactive. They're talking about the value of education. They must put money where it belongs and pay academics fairly.
The Prime Minister, James Marape, was a former student of yours. What's your message to him?
You know, to do away with dual salary and pay the Papua New Guineans better. That's my message to him.
So as Dr. Marae explains, the PNG government has always known this was a problem. And in the early 2010s, under Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, it even went as far as funding a nationwide review. Consultations, research, and a full study into how the dual wage system could finally be dismantled. But when the findings reached cabinet, everything stopped. The review went nowhere. And to this day, no successive government has acted to close the gap. Politok reached out to the PNG government and the Department of Personnel Management, the agency responsible for public sector pay structures, but we did not receive a response. So what does that mean for Papua New Guineans working right now? What is it like in the modern day to live and work in your own country and to watch a decades-old demoralizing pay system continue untouched?
You spend your 4 or 5 years of your life going to university only to, you know, to work and be paid so little that you can't afford rent. And that's the reality for Papua New Guineans, young Papua New Guineans working in Port Moresby. I couldn't think of anything worse.
Elvina Pocky Ogil is a Papua New Guinean woman, now a commercial lawyer based in Sydney. But the very year the government commissioned its review, she moved home to Papua New Guinea to work for a multinational company. And she saw firsthand what the dual wage system looked like in practice. Elvina, before you entered the workforce, how aware were you about the dual wage system? And was it something that touched your life before working?
I was aware of it because I, you know, had a Papua New Guinean professional parent. My dad was employed in Papua New Guinea, and he was very conscious and operated within the system. He was remunerated as a Papua New Guinean in comparison to his expat peers. But I was very much aware of it even before I started my working life.
Elvina, tell me about your experience working back in Papua New Guinea after working between both Australia and PNG. What did you learn about the dual wage system?
In 2014, I made the decision to return to PNG for a number of reasons, but I think we all sort of have this idealistic notion of wanting to contribute to our country when we're Papua New Guineans who are educated and who live abroad and who have sort of the benefits of an international education, where we think, you know, we can go home and in some small way contribute to the development and the progress of our country. And I think that was sort of the underlying motivation. I took up a role and I worked in that particular role for about 4.5 years. I mean, I don't think there's any sort of nuance to it, really. Papua New Guineans are given a separate call number, for example, such that whenever we would call the transport system, you're immediately delineated as a Papua New Guinean and the offerings of service to you are more limited. And the wage system was very clear who was paid differently. I was remunerated relatively well, but it was made clear to me that at the time, because I held a Papua New Guinean passport, I would be paid as a national lawyer, in inverted commas. And quite often the wage gap was significant and it was very, very transparent. I don't think there were Papua New Guineans that were under any illusions as to how dismally they were paid in comparison to their expat colleagues.
How large was the pay gap? I mean, for your case, how large was the pay gap?
Well, for example, Papua New Guineans were not given any accommodation privileges, right? But if you had an expat admin, which shockingly we had admin staff from Australia. So for example, at that time I was a trained lawyer. I was admitted to the Supreme Court Bar of Queensland, but I was not provided with accommodation working at ExxonMobil. However, my admin had accommodation provided for her at, you know, the Edge or Peninsula or Airways, etc. So the difference would be that Papua New Guineans did not get any accommodation assistance whatsoever. If they did, it was in the form of an accommodation allowance, which if you live in Moresby, rent in Moresby is astronomical. So the allowance that Papua New Guineans received as part of their salary while working at ExxonMobil probably would not have been able to pay for 1 week's rent in Port Moresby. So the majority of Papua New Guineans that I knew continued that great tradition of intergenerational living. They lived with their parents. They lived with their families, and there was no sort of provision made for that sort of assistance to Papua New Guineans, which I found to be quite unacceptable, to be honest.
What kind of an impact did you see, you know, all of this have on the PNG workforce?
I think there was a fair amount of, I don't want to sort of speak ill of my colleagues, but I think there was a fair amount of demotivation. We would talk about it a lot. I would have discussions with my colleagues, and they would quite often be candid about what they experienced as a disparity in their income. And I would say it would overall have an extremely demotivating impact on Papua New Guineans. And, you know, I don't have the data in front of me, but I think there has possibly been a brain drain in terms of Papua New Guineans like myself. And I mean, I'm probably someone who has experienced this firsthand. I left Papua New Guinea because I sort of couldn't tolerate this anymore. And I had the opportunity to leave Papua New Guinea, and I took that. And I'm an Australian. I've been here for the last 8 years or so. But it most definitely has had a demotivating impact on Papua New Guineans. I mean, you know, you're expected to attend work and deliver in the same a manner that your expert colleagues are, but your living circumstances are so vastly different, right? You live, you know, as an example, you probably say you've got someone who lives in Gerahu. They can't afford to live sort of independently, so they live with multiple family members. Transportation is difficult. For example, would provide individual transportation for their expert colleagues, but Papua New Guineans would be expected to catch the bus. So the disparity came down to even the most basic things such as of transportation to and from work. And it speaks to an overall sort of, I don't know, devaluing of the contributions of Papua New Guineans.
Now, you said that you've spoken about this issue extensively. Did you speak up about it at work, and how did that play out?
I don't think it played out very well for me, Scott. I mean, I spoke out about it extensively because I think I had the comfort and security of knowing that should things go awry for me personally and professionally, I had the option of exiting. And so I guess for me, it was, you know, I felt comfortable enough to speak up about it whenever I saw it and whenever it impacted me personally. And I think, you know, it is difficult for Papua New Guineans who have no alternative but to maintain their employment in Papua New Guinea to speak on these things because they are probably very much aware of, you know, any negative ramifications that may ensue if they do. I don't think it was appreciated by my expat superiors. I mean that I use that term very lightly. I mean, you know, the senior management. But I think it is a conversation worth having. And I think Papua New Guineans would benefit from it if we continue to have these discussions such that there's meaningful change.
What impact on women specifically does this system have as a whole?
A lot of the women that I spoke to were the sole breadwinners for their families. I would go as far as to say they are quite negatively impacted by disparity. And then, you know, if you add that to sort of some of the issues that women generally face in the workforce in Papua New Guinea and in their personal lives, et cetera, the issues of financial abuse and all of these sorts of things, I think when you're earning a substantially lower income to your expat colleagues, you're already at a position of disadvantage. I was friends with Papua New Guineans who had similar qualifications to myself, some of whom had obtained an overseas education, and these were young women, their salaries were significantly lower than that of their expat peers who, in many cases, did not have the same level of education, experience and qualifications, etc.
Now, in 2013 and 2014, the former Prime Minister ordered a review of the dual wage system, but after thousands of kina being spent on the studies, it went to Cabinet, it was shelved. How did you feel about that situation?
Disappointed. I mean, I think this is probably, you know, I think it's great that such a review was ordered, but again, super disappointing that it's been shelved. I would hope that the Marape government would consider it worthy of a review, considering where we are economically.
Why do you think it's important to keep this conversation in the spotlight?
Because I think this has gone on for far too long, and I understand that there are, you know, there's no easy fix to it. Really, it's important that in Papua New Guinea, Papua New Guineans are recognised and treated as for what they are worth. And I think it's very, very important that 50 years of independence, and we still have not achieved anywhere near the sort of wage parity that we should have as a developing modern economy. And that's, you know, that's probably why I've spoken about this at the risk of sounding like a broken record for so long.
What impact would a change in the dual wage system have on Papua New Guineans?
I'm not an economist, Scott, but I think that it would have significant microeconomic impacts on people's livelihoods. You pay an individual more, or at least what they are worth, and they are likely to support their families better, support their communities better, be able to educate their children well. And it would just contribute to overall lifting people out of certain standards of living within which they are stuck at the moment.
In Elvina's story, you can hear the echo of Anya's. Two women, decades apart, walking into workplaces full of hope, only to find that somebody, somewhere, had already decided what they were worth. And then there's Dr. Leo, who didn't just feel it, he measured it, who spent years turning quiet anger into data, only to watch it sit, unread, on a shelf. Together, their experiences sketch out the full weight of the dual wage system. It's not just about foreigners earning more. It's about who gets to stay, who is pushed to leave, and what kind of a country is left behind when most of your determined people decide they cannot build a life at home. The dual wage system was designed in another era, under another flag. But today, the choice to keep it or to finally dismantle it belongs entirely to Papua New Guinea's leaders. Politalk is hosted by me, Scott Wyde. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Stunzna. Coming up next week on Politalk.
I think with Honourable Prime Minister Lauli's current approach is that there's really no separation between church and state now for Samoa. He is freely implementing policies and proposing activities for public servants that are very much about Christianity.
On Sunday, almost everyone in the Pacific will be at church. But in the Pacific, Christianity doesn't stop at church doors.
I don't think we've ever had a leader who hasn't professed some sort of link to Christianity. When we go back to colonization, Christianity was the methodology used by these colonial entities to take control of the education system.
When faith moves beyond the pulpit into politics, what happens to democracy?
Power looks most dangerous when it's wrapped up in religious language. And when political agendas claim divine approval, dissent is then framed as disobedience to God. And that kind of power silences conscience, it legitimizes harm. And I saw quickly in these states, in these cases, how faith could be weaponized to justify exclusion, to justify even violence. And religious symbols and scriptures, you know, at times were used to sanctify political actions that contradicted the core values of the gospel. But at the same time, I witnessed another form of power, moral courage.
That's next week on Polytalk with me, Scott Whitey. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.